accession number 3790, reel 5.
Mr. Johnson, reel 5. You tell me about the differences and similarities between the two camps, Hay and Tituba.
Well, Hay was in the desert. It was prairie. We had lots of dust storms, and which was very unpleasant. We had a few scorpions which were killed occasionally. One of our members collected on his working parties lizards, which he put into a little zoo, and which he took with him later on to Tatura. Yes, when we were in Tatura, and we were in a hilly area, which was, I don't think there were woods, but there were trees, and it was green, and we were taken by the major in charge of the camp, who was a Scotchman, who had served in the Middle East during the First World War. We were taken to a river where we could swim, and he gave us elementary military exercises, and he actually volunteered to the Ministry of Defense or Ministry of War in London to take charge of us, to take us to the Middle East if the war office would agree to let us serve in the Middle East, which was, of course, not practical from British point of view, because an internment camp run in Australia under British auspices, even if it was run by Australian soldiers or officers, still remained British, and we would have had to be returned to Britain before being sent to another country for service. In Tatura, as I said, the unit was very small. We were less than 200 people. I was in charge of the hospital because we didn't have a medical hut. We had one doctor, Dr. Günther Weiss, with us, who was in charge. And we experienced for the first time cold conditions, which we had not experienced in Australia before, the so-called winter, because we stayed there till the 11th of August, which after all is the winter there. And we had sometimes 20, 22 degrees centigrade at lunchtime, and indeed at night it became freezing point. And when we woke up in the morning, we had hoarfrost, as a result of which some of our people suffered of frostbite. And I had to learn how to treat frostbite in a simple way, which was very useful for me because as I was medical orderly in my company in Normandy later on and in Belgium, and I could use some of the practices I had learned in Australia.
What did you do for frostbite?
Well, frostbite, we gave hot and cold water treatment alternatively, and we also had an ointment which I later on took also from the German military hospital in Brussels, which I used for treatment of frostbite. Well,
could you tell me about people's reasons for joining the Pioneer Corps? It seems a bit odd in a way, because after all, Britain had imprisoned you, and there you are volunteering to help the country that's being so cruel to you.
Well, the thing is this. Many of us refugees, I'm sorry to say, felt more patriotic than many English people. And it was our great wish to help the war effort as best as we could, some in industry and some in the forces. Those of us who had not applied to join the army before we were interned, because we thought that we would be able to serve in industry. There was, as I said before, there were three companies formed who had been in France during the Phoney War, the companies 87, 88, and 93, who had been withdrawn after Dunkirk and Saint-Malo to England. But many of us who went to Australia had second thoughts. We saw that we could not get out in Australia to help the war effort in 1941, and so we volunteered to come back to England and do our best there. We fully realized that many of our relations were in Germany, Austria, or the occupied countries. There would be a certain risk that if we were taken prisoner, we would not be protected by the British government, as they could not protect us because we were stateless. But nevertheless, we considered that it was our duty to return and join the war effort. I was in correspondence with my father through Red Cross letters. My father was in Holland, and he had been offered to be taken underground, which he refused. So he was deported to Auschwitz in October 1942, where he was gassed on arrival. But he was, of course, very pleased that I was in Australia, away from the firing line. But I couldn't very well tell him that I was going back to England in order to do what I thought was right.
Did the British government offer you any promises? If you will join the Pioneer Corps, we'll help you get naturalization.
There was no promises made whatsoever, and I've just looked up a newspaper report published in 1941 in the Zeitung, where a MP called James, I don't know which party he belonged to, raised the subject in Parliament, and he got a very snooty reply by the government speaker who told him off for even raising the subject, sticking up for the refugees who joined the Pioneer Corps or other units of the army. But it was not done in Britain, whilst the Australian army, within 6 months of refugees joining the American army, they became American citizens, and the same applied in Australia. We considered the British very unfair in this respect.
One of the things about camp life, I should think, would be with all those men together, particularly in Hay, a larger camp, but in any of the camps, and the restricted, confined conditions, I think there might be a problem with homosexuality.
You're perfectly right. You're perfectly right. We had a few cases of homosexuality. And the amusing thing was, from my point of view, that some of these men who seemed to be homosexuals had been happily married, and it showed that there is something male and female in all of us. And these people were just bisexual. We had amongst the doctors a Dr. Böhm, who was an homosexual. And as this was known to the other doctors, we always made a point that there were at least one or two orderlies in the hut, in the medical hut, when he was examining or attending to the football casualties. I understand when he was released, he became a doctor in Melbourne during the war.
But anything done to try to discourage homosexuality, or was it tolerated?
Well, you can't. Just as in the British Navy, in the Royal Navy, it is tolerated. When a ship has been out at sea for more than 6 months, it had to be tolerated in the camp. And usually the homosexual practices took place in the evenings, in the shower house. It was generally known that there were love scenes going on, but we just laughed it off. But we know that from contact with some of these people after the war, or after return to England, they became very happy married partners of their wives again, and all was forgotten.
It's interesting you mentioned that. I've often thought that internment must be like being on a ship, in a way.
Exactly.
Could you ever get out for exercise?
Well, we did have working parties. In Hay, we had a working party which was supposed to build a camp, some agricultural settlement. But I don't know what happened. I don't think that the sand conditions, the occasional sandstorms, were very conducive to this sort of thing. There was a party which went to collect stores in Hay, and that was the only contact point between members of camps, inmates of Camp 7, Camp 8, and so messages were occasionally passed across, but there was no proper working party otherwise. But a few of our boys worked in the camp of the soldiery outside, in, as far as Hay is concerned. And as I mentioned before, that one of our painters and sculptors did some work for some of the officers and personnel of the camp outside, and who sat in the camp, I think, and then sometimes they went outside, I think, and finished their jobs off. But otherwise, there was nothing in Hay. And to Tura, as I mentioned, we went on marching exercises outside the camp, and we once or twice went swimming.
Your military training must have consisted primarily of drill and movement.
Yes, exactly. No, of course not. I mean, we could use broomsticks to be shown how to present arms, but that wasn't terribly important, I don't think. Well, from the Tura, we were sent further west to camp at a place called Barmera, B-A-R-M-E-R-A, which is north of Adelaide, and which the Australians called Love Day. And we were there from the 12th of August 41 until the 15th of September 41. What was amusing for us, when we changed trains, first news from New South Wales to Victoria, and from Victoria to South Australia, there were different gauges on the railway line. That means New South Wales had the normal one, and I think Victoria had the wider gauge, which they have in Russia. And South Australia, I think, again, had the normal gauge, which they had in New South Wales. And for us, it was rather amusing to see this. Coming back to Loveday Camp, Obama Camp, this was a very hot camp and very unpleasant from the climatic point of view. But on the other hand, it was situated in an area where bananas and oranges grew, and our working party went outside to gather a fruit for commercial reasons and got pocket money for that. And this way we got also into our canteen bananas, which were a good foot long, which had a circumference of three and a half inches, something we'd never seen in our lives before, which of course was amusing to rather erotic minded people, comparing them to the sort of fellas they would have liked to have. The oranges were very large. We also got lemons there, and we were introduced to passion fruit. Passion fruit was put into our ice cream, which we produced in our camp. We heard afterwards that Barmera camp was meant for German prisoners of war who were most likely dangerous enough to escape, and for that reason this camp was empty, and for that reason we were packed off there, but we only had a short stay, and the future army personnel were shipped on the 15th of September to a place called Liverpool, which is a suburb and a rifle range outside Sydney, where we arrived on the 17th of September 41, and were then released from there on the 15th of October 41, and shipped back to England. I've got here the last letter I wrote to my mother on the 2nd of October 1941 from the internment camp, Anzac Rifle Range, Liverpool, New South Wales, outside Sydney, in which I told my mother not to write me any more letters because I hoped that I would be en route soon. And I said, we had torrential rain here after a terrible heat wave, and I spent my time writing letters, and this was the 37th letter sent from internment in this period of 13 months I spent in Australia. And I was doing my darning of socks, but other clothing which had to be repaired I gave to somebody who was more expert at that. And I also told my mother that I had arranged with David Jones at the store and mail order firm to send a small food parcel, which I hoped would arrive in time for Christmas. But actually, I was back by that time in England.
How was your trip back?
Well, the trip back was interesting. We were loaded onto the SS Ceramic, which was a shore several ship, a passenger ship, and I shared a cabin with a chap by the name of Robineau from Hamburg, who is a merchant banker in the City of London, who has had several pats on the back in the Financial Times in recent years. And we had on board ship some Australian timber corps, what do you call them, woodpeckers, wood chopper, what do you call them, people who, what do you call them, foresters. And they were very rough diamonds. But as we had learned in Australia how to swear, they got tit for tat from us. And although we were called limeys. We lived as civilians on the ship, and we were treated as civilians. Of course, we were under military discipline. And when we left Sydney Harbour and saw one of the queens in the harbour, and I was told afterwards that the queen we saw, the queen liner we saw in the evening, was not the one which we saw next morning. Apparently they had been swapped. And one of them apparently had a false funnel erected on it so that they both appeared the same. And they were, at that time, so we were told, used as hospital ships in the Far East. Well, we left Sydney in beautiful weather and made first for Wellington, New Zealand. And in New Zealand, some of our people, were taken off and transferred to Auckland, where they joined the Stirling Castle, a much bigger liner, which was to travel through the Panama Canal and straight back to England, doing enough mileage not to require a convoy. Now, we had arrived in Wellington, and there we took on board apples and mutton for England, and we also took on board New Zealand Air Force personnel, ground staff, and these were the first New Zealand Air Force personnel who traveled straight to England for service and did not go to Canada for pre-training. Whilst we were in New Zealand, of course, we internees were not permitted ashore, but I managed to smuggle out a letter to a member of the International Friendship League in New Zealand in order to get that back to our General Secretary in London to tell him that I was on my way back. The New Zealander whom I sent the letter to, I think, was a composer of Greensleeves, quite a popular song. I don't know if the letter got back to England. We stayed in the port of Wellington for 7 or 8 days, and we left the port on the 27th of October, 41. But we left only for the outer harbor. But at the same time, a merchant ship of the Free French Merchant Navy, left the harbor at the same time, and that was to travel to the French possessions in the Pacific. We stayed on the outer harbor for a day, and the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Mr. Fraser, came aboard ship that morning, very early in the morning, between 7 and 8, in order to say farewell to the New Zealand Air Force personnel. And he asked somebody to go downstairs on below deck to call our spokesman, because he wanted to have a chat with him. His name was Brach, B-R-A-C-H, and he originated from Hamburg, and he was in the shower, and he thought it was a bloody joke. And so he stayed under the shower until somebody else came down. Come on, hurry up. Prime Minister Fraser wants to see you, and it is no joke. So he dressed quickly and came up, and he had a chat with Mr. Fraser and gave him the background of our party and what we intended to do, and Fraser wished us good luck. And then we sailed on. We had 27th of October also, no, on the 20, sorry, we left the port on the 26th of October, not on the 27th, because on the 27th we crossed the dateline, which meant that we had a menu twice dated the 27th of October. 27th of October, having been my mother's birthday, of course, was a memorable occasion for me, and so I kept the two menu cards, which were issued with, and given to my mother on my return home. We sailed for the Panama Canal, and when we were standing off and waiting for the pilot didn't come. And we had to stay offshore for a day or two, because the following was found out afterwards. The Germans had a spy in Wellington who operated a shortwave transmitter. And he had been advised by the Germans operating in the Pacific that the ship which had sailed out of harbor at the same time as we were, and he didn't know there were two ships, had been taken over by a German prize crew and was now traveling under French flag with a German prize crew on board, and this was referring to the French merchant ship. And consequently, when we got to Panama, which was controlled by the American Navy, they assumed that we were traveling under a British flag with a German prize crew on board and trying to enter the Panama Canal and possibly damage the locks in the Panama Canal. Anyway, the thing was sorted out and we were admitted. And so we could bunker coal and travel through the Panama Canal. And it was quite an experience. And we saw the biggest French liner lying in one of the lakes, immobilized, because it would not surrender to the Free French. I can't remember if it was the Normandy or the France, but I think it was the Normandy. And we then sailed through the canal and saw some American troops lining the banks and left on the South Atlantic side. And then we traveled north to St. John, or St. John as you probably call it, in Newfoundland. And we arrived there when it was snowing. Anyway, the Australian diggers and the New Zealand Air Force personnel were permitted ashore, which we were not. And when they came back after their booze up in the evening, we pelted them with snowballs. Well, the New Zealanders knew what snowballs were, but the Australians had never seen them. But they soon caught on, and they pelted us with snowballs as well. Some of the Australians tasted the snow first to see what it tasted like I've seen in Europe dogs do when they had never seen snow. In St. John, Newfoundland, we were linked up with a convoy of 26 ships, and we were escorted out by a couple of frigates for part of the journey. And by that time, of course, winter had come, and it must have been end of November, beginning of December 1941. Unfortunately, the British Navy and the Canadian Navy did not have enough frigates to take us right across to Britain, and so we were in danger of submarine packs. And our convoy comprised merchant ships carrying food for Britain, and it also comprised oil tankers and also ships like the Ceramic, which was probably one of the biggest in the convoy, carrying passengers and foodstuff. When we came to an area south of Greenland, we got into a North Atlantic storm, which are prevalent at this time of the year. And by that time, of course, we had no escorts. And we were told by the commander, or our captain was told by the commander of the convoy to disperse and meet in a certain spot 24 or 48 hours later. Well, we didn't know that. The instruction was 24 hours later, but our captain thought it was 48 hours later. And during the storm, some of the glass windows were battered and torn, and we had to put up wooden boards to cover the windows so that the water wouldn't come into the decks. I served again as medical orderly to Dr. Weiss, and it was not very pleasant conditions. We had to do a tooth extraction on a chap who had a molar tooth, a lower molar tooth, which had to come out, which turned septic, but the tool we had was suitable only for an upper molar, and consequently the poor bugger had to suffer badly, and we could not extract the entire tooth. As we did not have proper chloroform, we had to use ethyl chloride,